Welcome to Season 3 of the Sober Motivation Podcast. Join me, Brad, each week as my guests and I share incredible, inspiring, and powerful sobriety stories. We are here to show sobriety is possible one story at a time. Let's go! In this episode, we have Suze from England who shares she faced various significant life challenges, including being sent away to boarding school at a young age, facing bullying, the sudden death of her mother, and surviving the terrifying 2004 Boxing Day tsunami. She discusses her struggle with alcohol, which became a coping mechanism following these traumatic events, and the subsequent dip in her mental health. Despite initially starting to drink socially in her late teens, Sue's real battle with alcohol began in her 30s, intensifying by trying to moderate her consumption without success. Eventually feeling trapped in a cycle of drinking, she sought help. And this is Sue's story on the Sober Motivation Podcast. How's it going, everyone? We're 3 months into a new year, and I'd like to take a pulse on how everyone's doing and feeling. If you made the commitment to get sober in 2024 but are struggling to stay accountable, check out SoberLink. SoberLink is an accountability tool that will keep you honest. It uses a really high-tech breathalyzer system to help when those cravings get a little too loud. Here's why I love it. You'll test at the same time every day, eliminating testing anxiety. Devices have built-in facial recognition so it knows it's you testing. Tamper sensors flag any attempts at trying to beat the system. Friends and family receive instant test results, helping to rebuild trust and prevent relapse. If you're serious about getting sober, this is a tool to use, and the only monitoring system I recommend. Make these next months count. Visit SoberLink.com/recover to sign up and receive $50 off your device. Welcome back to another episode of the Sober Motivation Podcast. Today we've got Suze with us. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Brad. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad we could finally narrow down a time for you to share your story with all of us. So what was it like for you growing up?
Yeah, so you can probably tell from my accent, I live in England. I'm British. I grew up in a place called Kent, which is just below London, so southeast England. And I had a really fortunate upbringing. I had a happy home. I have two big sisters. My dad worked really hard. And yeah, I was very blessed with how we grew up. But I was actually sent away to boarding school at a really young age. So I was 7 when I was sent away, which was kind of a normal thing to do in the late 80s. And now, obviously, I've got children on my own that age. And it's crazy to me to look at that age and see just how young that is, really. So I think that did actually have quite a deep impact on me throughout my life, but I wasn't really aware of it, obviously, at the time and how significant it would be. I was quite badly bullied at that school, particularly by like a group of girls who were older than me. So I always felt a little bit like an outsider at that school, and I would go 2 or 3 weeks without seeing my parents. So I think that was quite significant. I then went to another school, another boarding school when I was 11, and I was much more happy there. And I got a good group of friends, and yeah, I was happy and I was doing well educationally and in sport, and I was pretty popular and content and happy, really. So nothing really escalated or anything there. There was drinking starting to pick up around me in a kind of social circle around sort of 14, 15, 16, that sort of age. And I didn't actually partake, so I didn't start having the odd drink until I was probably about 16, which I know sometimes that might sound a little bit later than some of your listeners. But yeah, I was about 16, 17, and nothing kind of got out of hand. I don't remember my first drink. It was nothing spectacular. It was just what everyone did. And I just got into that pattern, just socially, I guess. I was never very good at holding my drink. So I had never had a very good tolerance. And I would always end up being sick quite early on. And this actually went on throughout my drinking history. I never really got a really big tolerance for it. So I'd always end up throwing up and then also having terrible hangovers the next day. But that didn't deter me, unfortunately. But yeah, my drinking didn't really take off, really. It was a bit later in life until my 30s, but that kind of happened because of some quite significant traumatic events that happened to me in my 20s. So first of all, my mum, who I was really close to, she died really suddenly. She actually had leukemia, but we didn't know. So she had a brain hemorrhage and just died really quickly. And that was when I just turned 23 and I was really close to my mum. And so that really threw me. I just, you know, when you're just going along and everything's going the way that it should do, and then a bomb goes off and it completely shattered my world, really. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I was coming or going. Everything I knew and everything that I was used to just was gone in that split second. And I think when someone dies really suddenly, it's that shock which really stays with you for a really long time. So I definitely didn't deal with that very well. And as I said, I've got two much older sisters and they were busy with their own families. So I was 23. They were in their early 30s. They already had young children. And I felt very alone and very isolated all of a sudden. And I didn't really feel like part of a family anymore. My family started to fracture because it was my mum who was holding everything together. I was in London at the time, so I was working, and I just threw myself into the sort of party lifestyle really in London, which I was able to function and go to work 2-3-4 hours sleep every Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, pretty much, and just got into this pattern. And although I wouldn't have said I had a problem, because I was still definitely social drinking, and I was doing what everybody else was doing as well at the time. So I wasn't doing anything unusual, but I was definitely covering up these sort of this emotion and this feeling of grief that I just wasn't handling it properly. The following year, I went to Thailand over Christmas with my then boyfriend, and I was involved in the Boxing Day tsunami. So I was on an island called Koh Phi, which is a tiny island. So I don't know if you know Thailand very well, but it's a really small island. And that's where I was when the tsunami happened. And the island itself is shaped like an H, and it has mountains on the side and then a really small area of beach in the middle, which is where all the small huts and things like that are. And what actually happened was the wave came. There was two waves. The first wave came and it split around the side of the mountain. So actually, it crossed the beach twice. So it met in the middle. And that's where, obviously, all the damage was done. So at one point, everything was underwater. And it was a really terrifying experience. And one that I definitely took a few years to even comprehend, really. I think even now I've managed to block out most of what happened, because it was more like a nightmare. It was like I was watching a sort of CGI film, and the memories are still quite hazy, even though that I had a number of nightmares and things like that for years afterward. And that's when my anxiety started. So even though this was 2004, my mental health definitely then took a dive. So we weren't really talking about anxiety and mental health that much in the early 2000s. But I can pretty much pinpoint exactly when things started to spiral out of control for me. So that was definitely very significant. And also so soon after my mum died. So I think the two together really compounded everything. And as I said before, my life just took a complete turn. When everything was going fine and everything was going well and I had a good job and my future looked really bright and I was in a really happy relationship. And this bomb went off on two separate occasions, like life-changing things happened. And that's when I kind of started to veer off course.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all that with us. Even going back to the boarding school thing, it's really interesting. Was there a reason that people went to the boarding school? Was it a behavioral thing, or was that just what people were doing?
Yeah, I think that's just what sort of people were doing around where I live and how I kind of grew up. And I think it's a sort of generational thing. For me, I had dyslexia and I was in the year, I don't know why, but I was put in the year ahead of myself. So everybody was older than me. And instead of moving me down a year into the correct age group, they decided to move me to a school that was maybe better suited to help me with my maths and my reading and things like that. But actually, it was much worse and it was a really bad idea. And I remember you have these, they're called the house master and house mistress. So the people who look after the girls' boarding school, and both of them were alcoholics. So I was basically being looked after by these couple who had a drinking problem. I wasn't aware of it at the time, and my parents knew, and I think they then lost their job. Or subsequently something happened. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy now for me to sort of think that I was 7 when that happened. It's really young, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking I have a 6-year-old and I couldn't imagine a day without her. It's interesting. Yeah. And them being away too, like you being in that situation, being away from your parents, how important that time is, like with your parents, and to build that relationship and to build everything else in our life. And especially too, you bring up the caregivers there might not have been the best caregivers that could have been teaching at the school. So that actually really was interesting to me. Did your sisters go through this as well?
They didn't leave that early. So they left at 30. So they both went at 13 to different schools. But yeah, I was the youngest by 9 and 11 years. So there was quite a significant age gap. So when I went, I don't know, my parents were maybe a little bit older and maybe a little bit more tired. I don't know. But yeah, it is crazy to me. I agree. My children are now 12, 7 and 3. And yeah, I can't imagine doing anything like that. It would break my heart to not have them here.
Yeah. Interesting. Uh-huh. So you go through that, and then the situation there with your mom too. I'm hearing you share this too. It's sudden. And maybe I'm guessing it left you with a lot of questions about things and how this kind of just played out. And then you mentioned too, starting to drink at 16. A lot of people I have from London, UK, everywhere, it's 13, 14. It seems to be, you know, I mean, fairly early in some books and maybe late in other books, but you get kind of started there. And you mentioned like you're getting sick and stuff from things too, right? And that kind of carries on in your story. Yeah, it starts so early. And you mentioned a few times there too, everybody was doing it when you got into this more professional scene, going out Wednesday, Thursday, just so normalized, right? It's so normalized in our Western cultures that the rite of passage is alcohol. The rite of passage to connect with people and be a part of the group is to drink. And I always struggled with fitting in. So it was perfect for me. It was just the easiest way into these social circles and to be a part of something. And at first, and maybe you could relate to this too, like it wasn't this massive problem. It actually was like pretty decent. There was like very minimal consequences outside of your regular, maybe young person not feeling well or things not going exactly the way I want them to, but it wasn't too bad. I kind of enjoyed it at first until we kind of go further through the process and then we want to quit. And then we can't quit. So,
yeah, I was going to say, I completely agree. It is so normalized at that age. So here, I think kind of any time from 16, 17, 18, and then particularly in your early 20s, that's just what you do if you're at uni or you're at college or you've just started working. And it is, as you say, like a really easy way to fit in with people, because you'd look more strange if you were the one saying, no, I don't want to go out and no, I don't drink. Then that would make you the odd one out. So it's just what everybody's doing. And that's what I did. And that's what my friends were doing. And yeah, it was so normalized. And it still is, sadly.
Yes, 100%. So you go through this tsunami too. And a lot of stuff that you mentioned there is still foggy for you. But that's after your mom passing away. And then you go through this too, right? And then you start experiencing anxiety after that. That's a very heavy thing. And you mentioned too, we're not talking much about mental health. And I had one guy on the podcast here, and he was on the PGA Tour, a golfer. He won a PGA Tour, and he had an anxiety attack, panic attack on the golf course, and he had never heard of anxiety before. So it was a very real thing that, like, we didn't really go there with things. So you go forward, and you begin to cope with alcohol, but maybe not even really fully knowing it at the time? Or did you kind of connect the dots?
No, I didn't connect the dots. And I think because it was so normalized and that I wasn't doing anything spectacular and I had no consequences at all, I wasn't behaving in a way that, you know, any different from anybody else. I wasn't drinking by myself. I wasn't drinking daily. It was all done going out and we were clubbing or in the pub or in bars or whatever. And although I did put myself in some really dangerous places and situations for the next few years and some really quite bad stuff happened to me, I never really had any consequences that I could kind of result because of the results of alcohol. So I never kind of thought these things are happening to me because I'm drinking too much. I never put two and two together, really. And yeah, I had no consequences. So for me, it was just what everyone was doing. And I wasn't aware that I was drinking to cope with these emotional feelings that I was having or trying to block them out. And it's just my way of coping. I think that's really kind of what happened.
Yeah. It's really interesting too. You mentioned there with the lack of consequences that are maybe black and white. If you get impaired driving, that's because you're drinking. Some people will wiggle themselves out of it to come up with this excuse or that. But if things aren't happening as a black and white direct result of drinking, then we can dismiss it or make it maybe just say that it was because of maybe something else, right? And kind of carry on. I did that a lot anyway. And when I look back, it was just a reason to keep going. I didn't really want to give up the drinking, so I didn't really want the consequences to affect that in a sense, right? So it's really interesting. So where do you go from here? I mean, after the tsunami, you were just there visiting then? Or were living there?
Okay. Yeah, no, we were just on holiday. So we were just for a 10 days holiday. And that whole experience, I think when you're in a situation where you think you might die, life takes on a whole nother level. And the fear and the trauma that I experienced, that I was then living in this sort of fight or flight mode. And I think it's quite rare that it is a symptom of anxiety, that sort of fight or flight. But actually, there aren't that many people who have been in a situation where for about 24 hours, you think you're going to die, because that was my reality stuck on that island. There was a naval ship, which was a couple of miles out of the coast. Someone had a satellite phone, because obviously we had like mobiles, but it wasn't like mobiles obviously we've got now. So there was like a couple of flip phones, but none of them was working. Nothing was working. So someone had this satellite phone and was communicating with this ship. And they kept telling us that this second wave was coming. Second wave was coming. So we were there and we were in one of the hotels, basically. It was the one high-rise building, which was about three or four floors. And they had turned it into a hospital, like a makeshift hospital. So that's where all the really injured people were coming before you could take them down to where the helicopters were landing to take them to the mainland. And so we spent 24 hours just waiting for another wave to come. And could this be the one that takes everything with it? And it was really scary. Like, I can't express enough. Like, it was just terrifying. And the things that I saw, you know, the people, the bodies, children who had died. Yeah, it's a different level. And for years afterwards, I would have these awful nightmares that I was drowning. And I think that's when my anxiety and my mental health really took a nosedive. So after that holiday, we came back to London and I was lucky that I had a really good group of friends and everyone was really supportive. But I think ultimately no one really realized what we had been through as a couple. And I started to act out and I started to behave quite erratically. I would get quite jealous of my then boyfriend. I would start rows in club. I would self-sabotage and do really crazy, irresponsible things. really. Normally, always when we'd been drinking or I'd been drinking. And this escalated over the next 2-3 years. And we ended up splitting up, which was really difficult for me at the time because I think I had these abandonment issues because of boarding school and because of what happened with my mum. And it was horrible, actually. That was really damaging when that relationship ended for me. And it took me a good few years to actually get over that relationship properly. All of the while, I was still kind of regularly drinking. Nothing extraordinary was happening. I then got into this relationship that I shouldn't have got into. It was very narcissistic, controlling relationship. And I got married really quickly and I ended up having my eldest child. And that came with a whole load of other emotion. And I managed to do 9 months. Obviously, it wasn't 9 months because he was premature, but that wasn't an issue stopping or drinking. I wanted a baby. I did all the right things, but I ended up having something called preeclampsia, which is very dangerous for pregnant women. And he was premature. He was 6 week premature and he was absolutely tiny. And we were actually in hospital because I came to hospital because I knew something was wrong. And the midwife didn't believe me. She basically said that I had a urine infection and that we needed to go home and there was nothing wrong. And I was in so much pain and I refused to leave the hospital. And thank God that I didn't, because I started to hemorrhage and I lost 2.5 liters of blood and he was out 11 minutes later by emergency C-section. And he was then really, really unwell because he wasn't breathing properly. And so he was taken away from me. And I was really ill. He was really ill. He was in intensive care. And if we hadn't been in the hospital, neither of us would be here now. So I listened to my body. I listened to my intuition as a mum. And I knew there was something wrong. And I knew I needed to stay in that hospital. And I do think that was something to do with my guardian angel, who was just telling me to stay in the hospital. Because thank God that I did. But then I come home with this tiny little baby. I don't want to talk too much about that relationship because obviously as the father of my eldest son, but it was a very toxic marriage. And I ended up asking him to leave when my son was only 5 months old. So I was there with this baby who I had real control issues with other people looking after him because I was terrified of something happening to him. So I think this was a result of what happened with my mom, the things that I saw in the tsunami. The control issues that I had really came to a head. And I think I was starting to drink then at home. So I think things shifted slightly. I was at home by myself with this tiny baby. I definitely had postnatal depression. I didn't have any help. I was feeling really isolated. I was feeling really alone. I was 31 with single moms. And yeah, it was a really scary place for me to be with this tiny baby who was quite unwell. And yeah, that was when I was probably I wasn't daily drinking at the time, but I was definitely turning to the wine more and more. And I just think these events just stacked up and I was beginning not be able to cope.
Yeah, I think in your story, especially, that's what thing happens here is if we're not getting any help for this other stuff, it kind of comes out in other ways, right? As we kind of go, you know, through the journey. It's always interesting too, right? Because in my story, I could always count on alcohol. I couldn't necessarily always count on friends or know how to talk to therapists or counselors. But I mean, you could spend $10 or $15 and I could get some relief from what I was feeling. Not knowing this at the time. I mean, this is all hindsight. Like I wasn't going through that thought process as I was making these decisions back then, but it was something that I could always count on to alleviate some of the pressure that I felt life was putting on me and working through these things. So you've walked away from this relationship and you mentioned it too, single mom, you're going through a ton of this stuff and these events are just kind of compounding and one on top of the other and the alcohol is an easy reach. Where do we go from there?
Yeah, so then I was living in London and I was working for a concierge company and I was doing pretty well. So my son started nursery when he was about a year old and I went back to work full time. And that kind of company is in London. There's quite a big sort of nightlife and social life around, there's a drinking culture basically around that kind of work. And it's harder obviously when you've got a child, and I wasn't able to do as much stuff as I used to be able to do, of course. But I definitely did start kind of going out more, organizing babysitters or things like that. But yeah, so there was definitely quite a big culture, drinking culture with work, and everyone was in their late 20s, early 30s. And it wasn't most nights that I think that's when I started to drink at home as well, particularly kind of weekends. I found weekends really lonely because it was me and my son, and I love him dearly, but I really craved that family kind of the relationship, and I really wanted that family unit. And at the time, lots of my friends had just got married or had young children, young families as well. And weekend could be really long and really isolating. And I think I definitely would turn to, I started having a bottle of wine in the evening, like Friday evening or Saturday evening. And this kind of carried on for the next couple of years. I did start a relationship then with my now husband, who I actually did meet him in my early 20s, actually. And we did go out. We had a brief thing in my 20s. And we got back together, and he's been amazing. And he is amazing. He's so supportive. We then went on and had two more children. So I had another baby when I was 37. And then I had my little boy at 39, my little one. And so I had this other traumatic birth with him. And I think at that time, that's when it all went completely wrong for me. He was in intensive care. He was really unwell. He had problems breathing. And they came and woke me up in the middle of the night on when he was about 12 hours old. And they got me to sign a bit of paper that they needed to do something called a pneumothorax, which is where they have to put in really big needles straight into the side of his a rib cage to press air, I think, or it's liquid on the lungs that they had to remove. And it's really serious. And I was thrust this bit of paper, which I had to sign. And I was there by myself. And it was at that stage, and I think I can honestly pinpoint it, I think I had some sort of breakdown. I couldn't cope anymore. I think all of these things, and I've slightly fast-tracked over the last 5 years where I was starting to get really depressed and my anxiety was like through the roof, and my mental health was terrible in my late 30s. Like I just wasn't coping with things, and this just tipped me over the edge completely.
Yeah. Wow. Did anybody ever mention throughout this journey here that like to maybe consider cutting back drinking or look at drinking or anything about it?
No, not at that time, because I think I was really masking pretty well. I was drinking at home now, like not socially at all. Like it was very rare that we would go out because young family. So we were drinking here. My husband doesn't drink a huge amount. So I think he just thought it was their sort of coping. And also we've got this whole mummy wine culture. Everything's normalized. So I don't think he thought that I was doing any damage to myself, really. And even though I was drinking maybe 5-6 nights a week, I was also really attempting to moderate for all of this time, pretty much for the last 5-6 years of my drinking. The moderation was really screwing with my head. I was trying desperately, like I knew that I should stop drinking, or I knew I wanted to cut back, but I just wasn't able to. And it was that classic thing of I would probably drink a bottle of wine. I would think that I'd only had one left, one glass of the second bottle, but actually the next morning, I only had a tiny bit of the second bottle left, and I'd tip that down the sink, and then I'd be like, I am not drinking. I'm not drinking again. That is not going to happen. You know, I'm not going to have any more. And then fast forward 5-6 o'clock that evening, I was going to the shop to buy another bottle of wine. And that was the cycle that I was in. And that would go on for 3-4 years, but I wasn't being vocal. I wasn't telling him. I wasn't asking him for help. I wasn't telling him that I've got this issue. It was all in my head. I go to AA now. And I know lots of people, when they eventually stop drinking, are in denial and then, you know, admit that they're in denial about it. I really wasn't. Like, I knew that I shouldn't be doing this. And I knew that it was damaging me. but I just didn't know. I didn't know how to stop. And I was just in this awful pattern. But worse than that, it was my mental health got to such a bad place that, you know, I was having suicidal thoughts. I had insomnia. I barely slept. I'd sleep for a couple of hours and then I'd be awake from 1 to 5 in the morning every single night. And it was the loneliest, darkest place to be during those 4 hours where I was desperately trying to just get back to sleep. And my head was racing. My mind was so busy and full. And I hated myself. I would look in the mirror and I would be saying the most awful, unkind, just things that I wouldn't dream of saying to anybody. I wouldn't say them to my worst enemy. I was saying all of this negative self-talk, awful stuff to myself every day, and all this self-loathing, shame. I was scared of everything. It was just awful. And all of this was because of alcohol. And I didn't realize that alcohol was having such a horrendous effect on my mental health until I stopped, until I took it away. And I still do get anxiety sometimes and I go up and down. My mental health is a bit up and down, but it's 99% better than it was. I was in such a dark place for so long. And yeah, it's just mind blowing how that moderation, attempting to moderate physically and mentally exhausting. It really is.
Yeah, I heard this quote one time. Abstinence beats perfect moderation every time. Because it's, like you said, it's trying to moderate an addictive substance. And that's where I think we lose sight sometimes is when we're wrapped up in it, we think it's my fault or I'm doing something wrong or I'm the bad person or I just can't figure this out. And although there is a responsibility on our part to make the changes, we're doing a dance here with the highly addictive. If you Google any list of what are the most addictive things, alcohol is going to fall in the top 5 every time as one of the most addictive drugs that we use. So it's that thing, I think, when we look back, we can see it, right? You're like, yeah, well, you kind of understand why it wasn't all working out. And then connecting those dots too about how it destroys our mental health, creates a ton more of anxiety. It just destroys the hope and the goals and the dreams and things we want to work towards. And we just feel stuck. I remember I was probably the same person for 3 years. It probably got worse. Like I didn't do any growth, self-development, any resilience or be able to do hard things or believe in myself or go for anything. And I was just stuck. And I just thought, maybe it's just not for me. But when I look back, it's easy to see exactly what was going on. I'm curious to wonder what prevented you from reaching out for help during these times, because this is where a lot of people get stuck, right? We hear these stories quite often where we're stuck for years, maybe decades, maybe months, but we get stuck and we got to ask for help. We got to get over that hump. What do you identify prevented you from reaching out in some of your toughest, darkest moments?
Yeah, do you know what? And I so wish that I had. I really do. I wasn't aware of the kind of the support actually available. Now, I didn't know about this amazing community on Sober Instagram. I didn't know about sober coaches or anything like that. I had no idea. I honestly felt, Brad, like it was me and I was the problem and nobody else on this planet had this issue. I thought you're either an extreme alcoholic who is sleeping on a park bench or that you can handle your drink. And I just thought I was the issue. So I wish I had asked for help. I did towards the end, about 6 or 7 months before I actually ended up stopping drinking. I did go to my GP here, my doctor, who unfortunately wasn't any help. I don't want to put people off from going to GPs and asking for help because I think some of them are amazing. It's just some of them really aren't educated in dealing with people who drink too much. Mm. And that was hard for me to ask for help. And then I didn't get it, which is really difficult. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up going to AA, because I just didn't know where else to go. I've had lots of people saying to me that my drinking wasn't at a level where I should have gone to AA, but I think that's completely irrelevant because the spectrum is so big. There's so many different levels to drinking. And the fact is that I couldn't stop by myself. And I haven't had one drink since my first meeting. So nearly 2 years ago, and that says a lot to me. So that's all I need to know.
Yeah, that's so true. It is interesting, right? Because I just did this short episode I released today about 10 things I wish I knew. And one of the things I put in there was that this decision is our decision. It doesn't have to be verified or co-signed or agreed upon from other people. And I think that's the thing, right? I'm thinking there when you say other people are mentioning or suggesting, why go to AA? Why go to a meeting? It's not that bad. Like, that would be like seeing people at the gym. You're already in shape, so why go to the gym? But you're only going to be able to keep that by keeping going. You don't have to be in this really bad spot to decide that you're going to start going to the gym. People of all levels go and they exercise to improve their life, and it's something they like to do. But it is really interesting because not only will other people sometimes talk us out of getting help, we often do it as well. We talk ourselves out of it. Maybe one time it worked out, a couple times it worked out. It wasn't bad. We didn't go through the whole stash or the whole collection we had. And it's like, it wasn't that bad. I didn't wake up feeling that bad. And the cycle kind of continues. But it's an incredible point to make that the difference it makes by just kind of throwing your hand up in the air and getting to that spot of, some people call it surrender, just surrendering. Like, I've tried everything that I could throw at this and it just isn't working out. So why don't I go out there and see what these other people who have got something figured out here, see if there's something I can pick up. So when did you get sober? Walk us through that. A couple of days before, what it looked like? How are you inspired to do this?
Yeah, see, I will. So actually, it was about 6 or 7 months before, prior to my actual sober day. We were on holiday. We were down in Cornwall, so like the southwest part of England. And there are really beautiful beaches and stuff down there. And we were down there with another family. And it got to a point where I was like sneaking drinks then. Like, I was drinking more than other people. And I was making excuses to stay at home in the house that we were hiring, because I just sent, you know, my baby's asleep and he wants to nap, and like everyone else went out and I was drinking while everybody else was out. And then when they came back, I just pretended that I literally just opened a, like a fresh bottle, and that's when everyone else joined in. So I knew there was an issue then, like I really did. And I hated myself and I was miserable. I was like having arguments with my husband. I really was so miserable. My mental health was so low. And I think I had some kind of, I don't want to say breakdown because it wasn't diagnosed as a breakdown, but one of the nights me and my husband went out for dinner and our other friends were looking after all the kids. And I'd been drinking that whole day pretty much. And I don't think anyone else had realized that I'd been drinking all day, but I just couldn't stop crying. I was crying and crying. My husband said he was terrified. I was scratching myself on my arms and my body. I was like digging in my nails to my arm, making my arms bleed. And I can't remember any of this. And I was just like pulling at my hair and just saying, I need help. Like, I need help. I just don't know what to do. I need help. And I think that was a kind of click. Something clicked then. And I was asking for help. And I wish I could say that was the day that I stopped drinking, but it wasn't. I said the next day, I was like, I'm going to stop. I was really ill. I was really hungover. I think I was sick. I hated myself. I really hated myself. And I think I didn't have a drink for maybe 2 or 3 days after that. But then you forget the feeling of what it's like to desperately, because the addiction takes over again. And that bad part of your brain is saying, no, come on, you'll make you feel better if you have this drink. So I then had another drink, but something then had changed in me. Something definitely had changed. And I was then back onto this like moderation hell. But at the back of my mind, I was like, that was really bad. What happened? That was really bad. And the day that I stopped drinking, it was April. My last drink was April the 29th. 22. And we had some people over here at home for dinner. So it was just like a regular Friday night, had, I think, six people over, so three other couples over. And I didn't behave particularly badly. I didn't do anything. It was a fun night. I'd probably had like maybe a bottle and a half, two bottles of white wine, something like that. But I felt so shocking the next day. And I had to get up and do some marshalling. So there was a run going on in our village where we live. And I had to walk up this really steep hill and basically direct the runners. And I felt awful. I was green. I looked shocking. And it was a really sunny day as well in like the end of April. And I was like sweating. I'm not a sweater. And I was like sweating. I just felt awful. And when the last runners went past me, I thought, I'm going to be sick. I'm going to throw up. I'm going to be sick. And I was sick, kind of bush. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. This is it. I'm choosing myself. I am over this. I've had my last drink. I can't keep doing this. If I do this, I'm going to kill myself. I was that low. I was that miserable. And at that point, so that was on the Saturday. And that's my sober date. So that's the 30th of April. And then on the Monday night, I went to a meeting. And it was the best thing that I ever did because I didn't know what else to do. I'd stopped for a few days. I'd stopped for a few weeks before, but I couldn't stay stopped. I had no issue going sometimes 4 weeks, sometimes 6 weeks without having a drink. But I would always go back and I'd always then just have to start again. But for me, I had just had it. I was just up to here. Was feeling like that and I needed to make a change. And no one was going to come and save me. No one was going to come and help me. I had to help myself. And the only way that I knew how was to look on my phone, put in my postcode, find an AA meeting. And that's what I did. And I just happened to go into this lovely meeting. And I was really lucky that the first meeting that I went to was a really nice group because it is a bit hit and miss sometimes. And this group was incredible. And I was sat next to the lady who's now my sponsor. And she's now literally like a mum to me. And that was my guardian angel moment. I was meant to be at that meeting. I was meant to meet her. I wasn't meant to get sober 6 months before. I was meant to get sober on that day. And everything has worked out for the better since that day.
Wow, that's beautiful. Was there anything specific you heard or was it the way you just felt going into that night that it just kind of made sense?
So I felt very emotional. I didn't want anyone to look at me. I didn't want anyone to speak to me. I just thought I'd just sit at the back and hopefully no one will even pay any attention to me. But obviously that's not what happened. This lady came over straight away, gave me a hug and I just burst into tears. And I just suddenly felt like these people get me and these people understand how I've been feeling the last few years. I wasn't this drunk person drinking at 9 a.m. or drinking all day, every day, but I was drinking 5-6 nights a week and I couldn't stop. And it would have got so much worse, so much quicker. And there was just something like, I just felt like I belonged. And I felt understood and I felt heard. And I didn't talk probably for the first, I don't know, maybe a few weeks probably of meetings. I just sat and I listened. And that first meeting, she said to me, don't listen to the differences. Just listen to the similarities. Just try and find the similarities. Because I was instantly thinking, these people aren't like me. They're not mums or like they're a lot older. Or they were drinking at 11 a.m. every day or whatever. I was looking for all the negative things and all the things that makes me different from them. But ultimately, there's so many things that you can relate to with these people. And they are amazing people. Like the people I know who have stopped drinking, whether or not they call themselves alcoholics or not, are the most special people in my life.
Yeah, that's incredible. So you felt at home. It's so interesting, too, that you mentioned there about wasn't meant to be an idea 6 months prior to that. And I don't think any of us want to go through any sort of pain or to endure addiction. I don't think anybody wakes up in the morning or sets a goal for something like that. But I do think that in my story and just kind of hearing that from you, that we've got to go through some stuff to get to a spot where we're willing, where we're willing to change things. It's almost like you feel for those people too, who are able to kind of keep this in a decent spot, because I think there's a lot of people whose their entire lives pass them by and they haven't been quote unquote too bad, or they haven't been that bad. But no matter where you fall, it steals. It really steals from our lives. It steals the joy. And it basically says is if you want to feel happy or content or be a part of this or do that, you've got to come through me first. It's like a gatekeeper in a sense for a lot of people, I think. So hey, what an incredible story and a turnaround. What's things been like you since you made that decision and you went into that meeting? I mean, it's so inspiring. You go to your first meeting and you keep going back, right? Because that's always what's suggested, right? Is keep going back. And what you shared too is another thing that we hear a lot, right? Is to focus on the things that are similar, not the differences, because everybody's going to kind of have their, obviously their own path to get to their meeting or their first meeting or wherever it is, their first place to ask for help. And like you mentioned there too, that's a very common track to go down. It's not that bad, or Johnny's got it worse, or Jim's done all this. I'm not there. One thing that was told to me early on is just put yet after this stuff. Just put yet after it. No guarantees here, but just put yet, because a lot of these things will be a part of your life if you don't choose sobriety. So what have things been like for you since?
Yeah, you know, really good, because you touched on it earlier, actually. You said you did those few years just with no growth and you just stayed the same. And I think that's ultimately what I had been doing. I might have had my children and I know I'm a good mom, but I hadn't done anything else with my life at all. I hadn't grown. I hadn't learned who I am. And in the last 2 years, I have done more than I have in the last 15. I have learned so much about myself. I have helped myself by sorting out my mental health. I have grown so much as a person, as a wife, as a mom, as a friend. I'm loving helping the community on Instagram. That's really special to me. One of the things that I really struggled with, as I mentioned earlier, was that I thought I was the only person who was going through this. And I wasn't aware how fantastic this community was. But as soon as I realized that actually I want to share my story, because I don't want anyone else to feel as lonely and isolated as I did when I was drinking. And that's why I want to tell my story. But I'm doing so much. I'm doing a college. I'm basically learning to be a counselor at the moment. I've nearly finished my first year and I'm just going to start my diploma in September. So yeah, I'm in a really good place and I just feel so happy and so content. As I said, my anxiety can be a little bit up and down, and I definitely suffer from a seasonal depression. So from like December, the last couple of months, it has been quite difficult, but I'm so much more in tune with my body. And if there's something wrong, like I know what it is and I know why and I can manage it. Before, my baseline was so low. I just felt crap the whole time. And now I'm up here and it's just a lovely place to be.
Yeah, that's so awesome to use. I mean, your education and your own experience to help other people. It is incredible. It's just so beautiful how things can change, right? You mentioned 2 years and 15 years, maybe not making much progress. I mean, still doing well in some areas. And then in 2 years, you can start to see this massive upside. The thing is that the alcohol is just in between us and who we want to be, or who we're supposed to be, or maybe who we've been before in our life before this stuff took over. And then you have the string of traumatic events that happen in your life that, because of the alcohol, we don't address stuff. We don't work on stuff. We don't ask for help. And then we don't get any resolve or any tools or ways to cope through these things.
Yeah, really, that you just said that actually, because that's definitely something within the first sort of 6 months, as I was doing most of my first step, was that I was really able to start dealing with that trauma and dealing with the grief and processing that grief. It's been 20 years now since my mom died, and it's coming up, there'll be 20 years at Christmas since the Boxing Day tsunami. But I hadn't dealt with these feelings, and I was living in the past and I was scared about the future. So I wasn't living. I was just chasing this kind of elusive, I want to be happy, I want to be happy. But I wasn't living for now. And I was carrying all of this like emotional baggage and all of this grief and all of this trauma around with me constantly. And it was just weighing me down. and I've really been able to just process it all, deal with it. I can leave it now. I can leave it where it needs to be and I can get on with my life, which has just been so freeing. And that helps with so many other elements. It's helped with my anxiety. It's helped with my mental health. It's helped with my sleep. And I don't say such toxic, horrible stuff to myself. I actually speak well of myself. And if I do get a little fleeting thought, I shut it down really quickly because I am so proud of myself. And I'm so grateful that 2 years ago, I decided that was my last drink. And I've got no intention of ruining that ever.
Yeah, let's keep it going. Hey, if someone's listening to this episode here and they're struggling to get or stay sober, what would you say to them?
I mean, it worked for me. I would look for an AA meeting personally, and I would do the same thing again. But I understand AA isn't for everybody. I think get informed, learn about alcohol, learn about the dangers of alcohol and how toxic it is to actually consume this product, which really damaging for your mental health. So I just think, yeah, get informed, listen to the podcast. There's so many amazing podcasts. There's so many amazing books that people have written, and ask for help. Ask as many people for help as you can until you get the help you need. But you have to take those steps yourself.
Yes, for sure. 100%. I love that. Yeah, get some help, read some books. And I think even too, in the 6 months you mentioned there, and it's a lot of people shares, we're kind of getting ready to be ready. So a lot of people think like you have to just be ready and then the light bulb goes off and then boom, you're in there and it all works out. But the reality is a lot of people spend time preparing to be ready. And you can do that by just listening to stuff and by reading books. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're quitting that day, but you can start that process. Of course you should. But I just know from having so many conversations with people, just most of the time it doesn't really work like that. But it consumes some information about and how people are living, right? Because we get stuck too, right? I get sober, now the fun's over. No more fun and life is boring. And if you can read and listen to other people's stories and read this information, you can realize too, that is absolutely not true. You might feel a little bit lonely for the beginning because we're so used to the stimulation from going out and connecting with people. And we have to learn new ways to do that. But the rewards just go on and on. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Is there anything that we've missed you'd like to share before we go?
I think we've kind of covered everything.
We did good then, I guess.
I think so, yeah.
Awesome. I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks, Brad.
Well, there it is, everyone. Another incredible episode here on the podcast. Thank you, Sue, so much for sharing your story with us. I'll put the contact information for her in the show notes below. And also, we have free meetings on SoberBuddy all through the month of April. Get signed up. I'll drop the link where you can sign up for that down in the show notes below as well. I hope to see you there in a meeting soon. It would be nice to meet everyone. And I'll see you on the next one.